Mr. Speaker.
Order, order.
Parliament resumed on Tuesday at 2 p.m, back from a fortnight's adjournment coinciding with the school holidays. For a preview of the first two sitting weeks, which will be followed by a week's break before a four-week session, including the budget on Thursday, May the 26th, here's the Deputy Leader of the House, Simon Bridges.
Mr. Speaker, when the House resumes on Tuesday, 3 May, the Government will look to complete the Appropriation 2014-15 Confirmation and Validation Bill, third reading of the Building, Earthquake Prone Buildings Amendment Bill, and make progress on a number of other bills on the order paper. Wednesday, 4 May, will be a Members' Day.
And that could be the highlight of the week if they get around to debating two bills, presently sitting in slots 2 and 3 on the Members' Order Paper. Both are from Labour MPs and have had the support of all opposition parties in their past. The first is the Keep Kiwi Bank Bill from Labour's David Parker. As its title suggests, its aim is to prevent the state-owned bank from being privatised by erecting hurdles such as requiring a 75% majority in the House or a public referendum on any proposed sale. It had the support of all opposition parties, including the Murray Party and United Futures Peter Dunn, giving it the 61 votes it needed for its first reading and referral to the Finance and Expenditure Committee, narrowly defeating the 60 votes of National and ACT, who then used their majority on the committee to send it back to the chamber with a recommendation that it not be passed. Mr. Park is ready to modify the bill, and it remains to be seen if it can retain the support of the Murray Party and Peter Dunn. They also voted for the original version of the Healthy Homes Guarantee Bill No. 2, but that was back in March last year when the resignation of National's Mike Sabin temporarily reduced the number of MPs in the House to 120, leaving the government one short of a majority. A tied vote of 60-60 on the bill's first reading was enough to stop it going any further. And now, with Mr. Sabin's Northland seat taken by New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters, the combined opposition parties have the majority they need to get the bill off to a select committee. And talking of select committees, here's Rhys Lyon to report on the ground cover this week as the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee continues its assault on the mountain of submissions received on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement.
Legal safeguards in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, designed to protect the government from being sued, may not go far enough to achieve their objective. That was the view of Medical Association Chairman Dr. Steve Childs when he appeared before the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee on Wednesday.
There have been concerns raised, of course, that the existing safeguards in the TPPA could still expose the government to potential challenges. For example, potentially in the future, if a government wanted to put graphic health warnings on sugar-sweetened beverages, similar to the plain packaging and the graphic health warnings on tobacco, etc., the question we would like to ask the officials is whether they believe the safeguards built into the TPPA would indeed protect against those potential concerns. For example, I understand that although public health measures under expropriation may be excluded in the investor state dispute chapter, you could potentially still, on a state-to-state dispute, challenge the issue of graphic health warning on sugar-sweetened beverages. So it could be that the safeguards in the TPPA do not protect the government from protecting the public health measures that you may wish to introduce for New Zealanders.
And the Medical Association chairman outlined other concerns for his industry over the TPPA.
The issue of the biologics, it's also been in the media quite recently, and of course that is the biggest growing market for therapeutics in New Zealand, most expensive, but also the fastest growing therapeutic product as well.
Dr. Childs was concerned about patent exclusivity for biologics, but first explained to the committee what biologic pharmaceuticals are.
The difference between a biologic and a chemical is just you sit down in a chemistry lab and you put some chemicals together and bang, you've made a chemical. A biologic, though, it's what you need to do is you need to get cells of, say, a hamster and get the hamster to produce what you want to produce in a big vat, and then you need to extract it and get the extraction just perfect and then turn it into some kind of pill that's effective. So it's the process of the production that you're trying to patent and you're trying to have intellectual property for.
And in another submission on the TPPA, Nurses Association President Grant Brooks also raised the issue of patent protection for biologic medicines.
which derive from protein-based living cells manufactured in a laboratory rather than traditional chemical compounds which are manufactured. These include vaccines, blood products, insulin, monoclonal antibodies such as Herceptin and Keytruda. When these have opened up a new world of effective treatments for many diseases and autoimmune conditions such as cancer and arthritis. Biologics, including their generic counterparts, which are called biosimilars, are the fastest growing and most expensive group of medicines, as our colleagues have just submitted, and these represent an increasing proportion of Pharmac's budget. The TPPA grants them a privileged position.
The TPPA increases patent exclusivity for biologics, whereby a company keeps exclusive knowledge of how to create a drug, and this caused concerns in the two separate submissions.
Under Article 18.52, market exclusivity for biologic medicines must be 8 years of data protection. The three-year difference from 5 to 8 is critical, since any delay in introducing competition will affect the medicines which can be included in the budget. It will literally be a matter of life and death to some New Zealanders if market exclusivity is pushed out towards 8 years.
Dr. Childs of the Medical Association agreed that data protection for biologics was a problem.
And if you can't get access to that data of how to produce it, the longer you can do that, the less there is going to be a biosimilar or a cheaper product on the market. So you're extending your cost monopoly for the producer of these products, of the most expensive primary treatment that we offer. It is a concern.
And Nurses Association senior policy analyst Marilyn Head summed it up like this.
I just wonder what Alexander Fleming would have said when he discovered penicillin, if they'd said, right, okay, we're going to patent that, or we're going to protect that information so that only people with enough money can afford that. It is the fastest growing area of medications, and right from the outset, it is being set aside for privileged access, without discussion almost.
Marilyn Head of the Nurses Association on Wednesday, while on Thursday the committee met again to continue hearing the broad range of submissions on the TPPA, including one from New Zealand Kiwifruit Growers Chief Executive Nikki Johnson.
We just wish to confirm our support of the TPP on behalf of the growers that we represent. There's $487 million worth of exports to TPP countries last year, and that's likely to increase. TPP covers our number one market, which is Japan, where $15 million on tariffs were paid last year for kiwifruit. In addition to the tariffs, Zespri, the marketing company which is owned by growers, has invested significantly in Japan. It has its own marketing staff based there and growing operations to support our 12-month supply objectives. The TPP also includes Chile, our main competitor in kiwifruit production for the Southern Hemisphere, and to maintain competitive advantage against Chile, New Zealand must be part of the TPP and obtain the same advantages, including tariff reduction, in order to maintain competitiveness.
Nikki Johnson summed up the key benefits of the TPPA to kiwifruit growers, beginning with the reduction in Japanese tariffs.
So that's currently 6.4%, which will reduce to zero on signing, which is an annual savings of $15 million for the industry, and that relates to around $6,000 per grower that will be in savings from tariff payments. But in addition to that, it will provide increasing opportunity for marketing and innovation investment. And what that ultimately does is result in improved profits for Zespri, and Zespri is owned by New Zealand growers. So that will result in those improved profits turning back into New Zealand growers and into regional economies, and in particular the Bay of Plenty. Zespri are predicting annual sales growth increasing of 33% in Japan over the next 5 years, and 51% over the next 5 years for other TPP countries, so significant improvements in sales growth. So the TPP is a benefit to us, and we strongly support the TPP.
New Zealand Kiwifruit Growers Chief Executive Nikki Johnson with that submission on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement to the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee.
That report from Rhys Lyon, and just in this week from the Justice and Electoral Committee, its report on its inquiry into the last general election. It's this committee's job to review each general election and recommend possible improvements before the next one. Among the many recommendations in this 45-page report are changes reflecting the rapid growth in advance voting, up from just under 15% of the total vote in 2011 to just over 29% in the last election. Labor MPs on the committee are not happy, though, about the government using its majority on the committee to block a change to prevent a repetition of what happened in 2014, when some 27,000 voters had their vote disallowed because they were not on the electoral roll. More to come on that, I guess, when the report is debated in the chamber. Now, as promised last week, here's the second part of our interview with the Deputy Speaker, Chester Burrows, who begins by looking at whether it makes any difference if a presiding officer comes off the opposition benches or off the Treasury benches before going into the job.
I think it's really about how you view your parliamentary career and what you're doing there and why you come to Parliament in the first place. If you're an angry parliamentarian who always insists on getting his own way on every occasion and never makes any friends, you'll probably hate the job as Speaker and you'll probably be hated as the Speaker. But actually, if you're somebody who is there and recognises that the public expect their members of Parliament to get on and not to have a fight on every occasion and use every opportunity to grandstand, but would rather that if someone had a good idea, then people voted for it, and if they didn't, they said why they wouldn't and just got on with the business of being in Parliament. And actually, I think people will respect a Speaker like that, and they're worthy of respect.
Lockwood Smith came into the job 2008, 2009, after 9 years on the opposition benches asking questions. This Speaker, David Carter, comes in off the ministerial benches. Do you think that makes a difference to their approach?
They've certainly got different approaches, but I think that they sort of put their own stamp on it. You've got to remember that Lockwood Smith and opposition actually led a very tidy campaign against Tito Phillip Field and was successful, and it was just about done completely on during question time and on Official Information Act requests and then the scrutiny of those in question time. So he knew the value of question time and he knew what could be achieved in question time, and we were all witness to that, so really it wasn't lost on anybody in the House. I don't think you could say that David Carter is softer on ministers because he immediately before being Speaker was answering them as a minister at all. I think that he does hold the government ministers to account pretty strongly.
Yes, I think so. I think he strikes a really good balance. I just wondered whether he was perhaps more interested in the questions having answered them, whereas Lockwood Smith was more interested in getting the answers.
Yeah, I think somebody could take that view, but I think that they do put their own stamp on it. I think David Carter does actually insist on quite a high level of compliance with questions, but he makes the point, and quite fairly. I mean, you can't chuck him on the rack and force an answer. If a minister gives a pretty crappy answer, then he lives and dies by that. So that's what will be reported in the newspaper. That's where the press release is from the person, the opposition member. You know, the story then becomes that the minister refuses to answer the question. Well, that's a story in itself, because the public immediately thinks, well, why won't he answer the question? So I think sometimes banging on about he's not answering the question and expecting there to be some punishment meted out for the minister for not answering the question is not the whole story. There are other ways.
Like asking another question.
Well, yeah. The minister being asked the question is being obstructive and not giving an answer or sort of answering some parallel question but not answering the question on point, then he can be drawn back to it. And what really happens is the spotlight's put on him that he's not answering the question. So you can then insist that he give another answer, but he's just going to wander out all over the place. I've never heard a minister yet give some sort of evasive answer to a supplementary question when being drawn to answer the same question again because the Speaker's allowed him to do that he's actually given anything completely different or sort of completely dug a hole for himself or anything else. The real condemnation is in not answering the question, and that's where the press release, that's what the public are interested in, and there are other ways of doing it, because it then gives full licence to the questioner to go out and say, well, this is the answer he wouldn't give, and then get the minister to refute that publicly. I mean, the fact is, some of these guys just aren't creative enough.
No names, no pack drill. The Deputy Speaker, Chester Burrows, there, while the week in the House started in spectacular fashion with a showdown between the Speaker, David Carter, and the New Zealand First Party. It began with this question from the party's transport spokesman, Dennis O'Rourke.
Mr. Speaker, this question is to the Minister of Transport. is the government committed in the long term to a sustainable railway network for New Zealand?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Simon Bridges.
Mr. Speaker, yes, because after years of underinvestment, this government's invested nearly $4 billion in rail and is committed to investing more as appropriate.
Supplementary.
Put a supplementary question, Dennis O'Rourke.
With a 60% increase in road freight since 2000 and thousands of additional trucks expected on state highways in coming years, how will the government ensure that rail takes a much greater share of the national freight burden in the future?
The Honourable Simon
Speaker, I suppose we could arrest people who don't use rail, but frankly, Mr. Speaker, we're allowing these different modes to play to their strengths. And rail does have a real strength over the long haul and bulk commodities. And in fact, in the last year, has seen its proportion of freighters' exports go up. I think as we see more big ships, as we see more inland ports, it will continue to be able to play to the strength that it has.
Supplementary
question, Dennis O'Rourke.
In addition to the four options in the Kiwi Rail Commercial Review 2014, the trimmed network, the separate islands network, the Upper North Island network and exit, will he request consideration of an expansion and improvement option for the whole country, and if not, why not?
The Honourable Simon Bridges.
Mr. Speaker, the member may not like the facts, but we've invested nearly $4 billion. That's comparable to what we've invested in the roads of national significance that he and his mates next to him, the Greens, love to hate so much. We are investing, and we continue to do so with projects that stack up.
Point of order.
Point of order.
I specifically asked whether the minister would...
The question was so long, it's very easy to remember to address any part of it. The member wants a short, sharp question. I can help him get a straight answer. Supplementary question?
The question was not
order.
Long, Mr.
Order.
Mr.
Member will resume his seat immediately. I have ruled. I'm giving the member a chance to complete his questioning. If he doesn't want to, we can easily move to the next one.
Point of order.
If it's a fresh point of order, I'll hear it. If it's any attempt to relitigate where I've just got to, I'll be asking the member to leave.
I'm simply asking if that question was too long.
I've dealt with that matter.
Dennis
O'Rourke will leave the chamber. I gave him an absolute clear warning. Order, the member will leave. Order. Point of order, Right Honourable Winston.
Speaker, my colleague asked the question, if it was too long, then how would you yourself have phrased it? Now, can I just finish my point of order? I've barely spoken a few words order. When you're jumping to
order.
Your feet.
The member can raise a point of order in line with standing orders. I'll hear it, but he better do it succinctly.
That's precisely what I am doing. My colleague asked
order.
The question.
It is a point of order.
If the question order. Was phrased too long...
Order. The member will resume his seat immediately. Now, this is a point of order, and I want to hear it without any interjection from my right-hand side.
Speaker, my colleague asked, if the question is too long, then how would you have phrased it? I think that he was seeking some clarity, because if the question was too long, you would have ruled it out at the very start when he finished asking the question. Now, that's why my colleague was a bit...
The member will resume his seat. I have been relatively lenient in light of the way... Order! The member's very likely to be leaving the chamber and joining his colleague. I've been relatively lenient with questions coming from New Zealand First today, but when they ask a lot... Order! If the member does interject while I'm on my feet again, he will be asked to leave. I've been relatively lenient, but when a question was as long as that, it is very difficult for me to actually decipher the specific of the question, and therefore I ruled that the minister had addressed the question. Mr. O'Rourke took exception to that. I warned him if he continued to relitigate a decision I've made, then he would be asked to leave the chamber. He then immediately did relitigate the question I'd made. If it's a fresh point of order...
It's a fresh point
order,
of order.
No, the member will also resume his feet. Resume his seat. Now, I've ruled on that matter. If the member's going to raise a fresh point of order... But if I consider in any way it's relitigating the decision I've just made, which the member doesn't have to like, but he must accept. If it is, in any attempt, I won't hesitate to be asking the member also to leave the chamber. Point of order.
Mr. Speaker, first of all, it is a fresh point of order.
What is it?
And that's why I'm raising it. Yep. Because it arises from your comment that you've been lenient to New Zealand First in question time today. As a matter of clarification, could you point out, on what occasions, at what time, have you been lenient to us?
That is effectively an allegation of bias. Order. And that is a contempt of this House. The Right Honourable Winston Peters will also leave the chamber. The Right Honourable Winston Peters will immediately leave this chamber. Order.
Elsewhere along the opposition front bench, party leaders were more concerned with trying to dig dirt by drawing a link between the Prime Minister, John Key, and the newly controversial foreign-owned trust industry. First question of the day for the Prime Minister was from Greens co-leader James Shaw.
My question is to the Prime Minister and asks, on what dates did he discuss with the Minister of Revenue his conversation with Ken Whitney on foreign trusts, and what specifically did he say to the Minister?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, there's no record of when I spoke to the Minister of Revenue, but it would have been between the 27th of November 2014, when the Herald story first appeared, and the 2nd of December 2014, when Mr Whitney emailed the Minister. I informed the Minister that I'd been approached by Mr Whitney, who acts for me in my personal capacity, that Mr Whitney was part of an industry group working in the New Zealand foreign trust industry, that I told Mr Whitney that I was unaware of the issue he had raised in the Herald story, and his group should meet with the Minister.
Supplementary.
Order. Supplementary question, James Shaw.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Did he tell the Revenue Minister to expedite his meeting with the foreign trust industry?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, no.
Supplementary question, James Shaw.
Did he tell the Revenue Minister to ditch Inland Revenue's recommendation to review the foreign trust sector?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, no.
Supplementary question, James Shaw.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Is he comfortable with the fact that his Revenue Minister told foreign trust lobbyists in his first meeting with them on December the 16th, 2014, that, quote, the government had no intention of conducting a general and public review of foreign trust rules?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, that would have reflected obviously the view and the advice he's got. It's consistent with IRD actually saying that it would have taken away from work that they want to do that was about the New Zealand tax base. But that's not what I instructed him to say, because I didn't instruct him to say anything in that meeting.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, James Shaw.
What evidence does he have that it was Inland Revenue officials and not the Minister who recommended that there not be a review of foreign trust regulation?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, I wasn't part of the meetings. I wasn't involved in that. What my only involvement was that my lawyer at the time came to me and said there'd been a story in the New Zealand Herald. I was quite clear and said, I have no idea what you're talking about, but you need to go and see the new minister as part of the lobby group. They went, and that's quite standard practice. And actually, people come and approach me every day, and I point them towards the ministers. And, Mr Speaker, just as an example of that, if the member was to ever...
Point of order, James Shaw.
Mr Speaker, my question was, what evidence does he have about that decision? He didn't address that part of the question.
I think on this occasion he clearly did. The question, when you said what evidence, the Prime Minister was laying out the evidence that he had for the statement made. Does the member have further supplementaries?
Supplementary, Mr.
Supplementary Speaker. Question, James Shaw.
So given that it was his own lawyer who asked for and was granted a guarantee that there wouldn't be a review of foreign trust regulation, is he not concerned about the perception that lobbyists can influence government policy on behalf of vested interests in New Zealand?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
The member's misrepresenting the situation. I was asked about a story that was in the New Zealand Herald. I made it quite clear I didn't know the details of that story, nor do I handle that. That's handled by ministers. And I did what is the fully and totally appropriate thing. I told the person and their lobby group to go and speak to the minister. That happens every day. And if the member was he ever get into government, is he saying that if Russell Norman ever came up to him and said there was an issue in relation to the environment, he wouldn't tell the person to go and speak to the environment? In New Zealand, we're a small country. People know other people.
Speaker.
Order.
First of all, Russell Norman is my lawyer.
If the member wishes to raise a point of order, he's welcome. Could I have the point of order, please?
Certainly. My point of order was that my question was whether he was concerned about the perception that lobbyists can influence government policy.
No, no. There was a lead-in to the question along the words, given that his own, there was a given a guarantee there wouldn't be a review or words to that effect. So there was quite a lot more in the question to which the Prime Minister took the opportunity to respond.
Supplementary, Mr. Speaker.
Supplementary question, James Shaw.
Will he consider following the UK government's practice of publishing ministers' diaries so that it is transparent to the public who at least is lobbying whom?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, no, but my diary and the things that I do are pretty publicly known. This was a situation where someone came up to me and asked me about a story in the paper, and I did what I think most New Zealanders would expect me to do, which is to say go and speak to the Minister.
Is this a point of order?
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
Point of order.
So again, my question was about publishing ministers' diaries, not his own diary.
And the very first answer, the first word given by the minister, by the Prime Minister, was no, he wouldn't consider it.
Mr. Key also faced questions from Labour leader Andrew Little.
My question is to the Prime Minister. Why on 13 April, when he told reporters that he had been approached by someone in the foreign trust industry who was concerned that the rules for trusts were about to be tightened, did he not reveal that person was his personal lawyer?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Because the name of the person was redacted and the information that was to be released under the Official Information Act. Member might like to note that there were six people who met the Minister. None of their names were identified in the Official Information Act.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
So what specifically, if anything, is inaccurate about this brief timeline? First, his personal lawyer writes to Revenue Minister Todd McClay, claiming the Prime Minister had told him foreign trusts will stay protected. Next, Todd McClay immediately meets the Prime Minister's personal lawyer and says foreign trusts will be protected. And finally, Todd McClay directs the IRD to drop its existing review of foreign trusts.
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, a more accurate reflection is that somebody who is involved in industry lobby group, who's my lawyer, asked me a question about something that was in the paper. I did what any professional Prime Minister would do and referred them to the Minister. I don't have a sign around me that says, if you know me, don't talk to me. And by the way, if the member ever gets into government, is he now telling us he won't talk to his union mates if they come and ask him a question or send them to a relevant minister?
Point of order.
Order.
That was a bad analogy.
Order. Order. I've got to ask for a little less interjection from my left.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Point of order, Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to table two IRD documents from August and November 2014, both of which confirm that IRD is planning to review foreign trusts.
Order. Leave us sought to table those two IRD documents. Is there any objection? There is no objection. They can be tabled.
Supplementary, Mr. Speaker.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
When the Prime Minister's lawyer went to a junior minister and said, the Prime Minister says you will protect my business, does he think that this just might have influenced that minister's decision-making in this case?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, well, the member's making it up. That is not what I said. I did what anyone would expect me to do. If I'm approached by someone, whether I know them or whether I don't, I refer them to another minister. That's also true, by the way, when constituents come to me and ask me about IRD matters, immigration matters, ACC matters, I write on their behalf to the minister. But the member doesn't say I shouldn't do that in case that junior minister is influenced by what I do. We live in New Zealand, it's a small country, and people ask me questions. I refer them to ministers.
The Prime Minister, John Key. I'm Tom Frewen, and this programme was made with funding from Parliament.